and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most wordy work as it releases. I'm Elliot Diebold.
And I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And despite what you just heard, it's just me today. This is still our holiday schedule, so it'll just be me this week and next week. But yeah, obviously Ruben returned the favor that I did for him a few weeks ago, and he sent me a bunch of voice clips. He was traveling while he sent them, though, so they don't all sound 100% good, but hopefully everyone can still make them all out. But yeah, I guess with that said, let's dive into the chapters. First up is Left in the Dust 16.3. This one's from Avery's perspective, and we're sort of jumping right back into where we left off last week. She's very distracted as Liberty is talking to Nora about something while she forgets to pay for Sheridan's food.
What in the star-spangled fuck?
That's right, Ruben. So yeah, I love how this chapter really opens with this moment of Avery being confused, because she's very, it's establishing that like blind spot, that stupidity that she has for, you know, Nora and just sort of, I guess, romance in general. And this is very much a chapter where a lot of the tension seems to be that you kind of get the impression that Liberty has threatened Nora or something. And obviously it pays off fantastically, but the first time through, you're very confused about all of that sort of stuff. And then Avery gets in trouble for trying to walk out without paying, and so she tips this lady with $20 from her personal fund.
And that's why Avery is the best kind of cheer.
Yeah, thanks, Ruben. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just thought this was a hilarious moment because it's so, not like new money, but very like Avery's somebody who doesn't, I think, understand the value of money yet. I mean, this is just kind of what happens, I think, when you give like a 14-year-old what was it, like $100,000 or something? Like she's just dropping 20s when, you know, she has any sort of mild problem. Somebody needs to get her financial literacy lessons, I think. It's just very funny, like how much longer can she keep milking the Garricks and then just sort of Avering away this money on stuff that, you know, probably isn't worth $20, I guess. I can't imagine ever being in a position to just drop 20 like that. It's just probably a good metaphor for the Kenneteers and how they got power at the start of the story as well. Like, this is very much what they were like when they first went to the BHI, just like dropping big spells and stuff, and all the other practitioners are like, whoa, holy shit. So yeah, like it feels like a nice extension on that whole thing that was established early on. Avery's got all this money and she doesn't really understand the value of it yet, I guess I'd say. Yeah, so I guess weirded out by Liberty and Nora's interaction, but not willing to push, the gang all go get some s'mores, which was something that was set up last week, which is really fun. And then they just, you know, gather around this shitty fireplace talking about life, the universe, and mostly how their parents have sort of fucked them up. And yeah, I mean, Nora's mum is a big part of this. We sort of learn that Nora's mum is tricky because she's like this example of when you are trying to protect your children from traumatic hardships you went through and you're kind of overcorrecting and just creating new ones. Like, Nora's mum is clearly just being so overprotective that she's hurting Nora in these other ways that she doesn't see. And we see this in practice when she shows up later, like, she'll say things and Nora's just, you know, she'll say things like, oh, are you ready to go? And Nora's like, no, but moves towards the car. And she just, you know, takes that as assent, I guess. So yeah, I mean, it's hard. You can really see why Nora's mom is the way she is, but also it sucks. It sucks for Nora. I'm glad that she's got people like Avery and now Liberty to, you know, get her birthday cakes, because those fruit platters do not sound like a good substitution in my book. And then obviously not to be outdone, Liberty brings up Daddy Teddy, and this is a great complication on like Anthem as a character, because I feel like everyone would agree that the thing he did for America and Liberty here is kind of objectively awesome. He told the patriarchy of their family to go eat shit and then was so successful that he made them eat that shit. But yeah, I don't know. Again, like, he didn't fix misogyny in the family. He got an exception made for his daughters, and like, we've seen how he wants to kill people like Toad Swallow or whatever to like get them in line. So it's also kind of double down on the bad side of the practitioner thing, where he now has all these expectations and rules for what he wants them to be. So he's like, it's this much more complicated view of Anthem now, where it's like he did a lot of good stuff, but he's also bringing the shit with it. And then that just kind of caps off with justifying the way Liberty has this, you know, these stars in her eyes, the star-spangled eyes for Anthem. Like, you can see why Toadswallow and Avery are just sort of not the ones who are going to jump on that grenade, because she's really deep in, like, worshipping her dad for pretty understandable reasons, I guess. I guess after all this talk of bad parenting, Liberty leaves for a bit to give Avery and Nora some alone time, and Nora is just about ramping up to ask Avery a big important question before everyone's favorite responsible big brother Rowan comes in to just, you know, see that things are okay. And I'd be interested to hear from the chat here, because, like, Avery very much comes from a place here where Rowan is just, like, a big pile of nothing. And like a really shit supervisor, but I don't know. I can't help but like, almost, if he was supervising her properly and watching her like a hawk, I think her idea of what would be good supervision is actually quite different to his. I don't know. I feel like if he was actually doing his job, she'd be more annoyed because he'd actually be there more. So it's like Avery's kind of condemning him for not doing anything, while at the same time, I think she'd condemn him twice as much for actually being there. I don't know. Yeah. If anybody in the chat has a strong opinion one way or the other, let me know. yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Rowan's there, Crawford, to specifically stop hanky-panky as much as, like, just that general impression that 14-year-olds need some sort of supervision. Like, obviously, Nora isn't out to her mum or anything, but when Nora's mum shows up, she's like, oh, wait, you're here unsupervised? Like, I think it's just a, you know, at 10 o'clock at night or whatever it is, there's an expectation parents are around 13, 14-year-olds. And yeah, you're right, it is a shitty fire. Yeah, I don't know. Avery calls him a goober, which I just loved as just such an Avery insult, for this moment where Taste of Death's brought up. Like, Rowan sort of takes credit for supervising him, and Avery's a bit like, the fuck did you even do? But I think that highlights the point, because she gets really mad every time he shows up. So it's kind of like, he's a bit damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. That said, it's Rowan, so mostly he doesn't. But I do think, like, to be fair to Rowan, for once, he's kind of in a no-win situation. But Rowan does eventually leave after accomplishing nothing. But Nora's mum shows up, kind of bushwhacking her, and makes her leave pretty much immediately. She doesn't get to say goodbye to Liberty or anything. And so then it just transitions to Avery and Liberty hanging out, just the two of them. And, I mean, we also learn here that Liberty is into this shitty CW show that Sheridan loves, which just, of course she is. I love the line, you need to watch from the start to understand the intricacies. As somebody who's watched a lot of CW shows in my time, there are no intricacies, Liberty, you're kidding yourself. Snowdrop plays with some goblins here, and she comes back with, like, a black eye. Like, it seems like the goblins have really fucked her up, which Liberty doesn't really seem to comment on at all.
Snow, no, she didn't.
Heck, yeah, good point, Ruben. I don't know. I guess there's some resolution next time, but Avery seems a lot more concerned about this than anybody else around here. So interrupting Liberty and Avery hanging out, the Tearaway Kid shows up, and the trio that we have here kind of talk out their plans for the build-up path the next day, and then we pretty much immediately cut straight to there. We're introduced to the build-up as Avery does some trades with the Garricks, and there's some great, like, path item drops here. I love this little jouncing ball. It feels particularly great for Avery, and it even gets a mention next chapter as being relevant for, you know, bringing path stuff into reality, which is obviously something we're going to be talking about, apparently. I think Ruben had something for this, too.
Or, as we say in Hawaii, find us, keep us, lose us is crying.
Yeah, thanks, Ruben. I think that was a good spot to put that. But yeah, another interesting thing about this jouncing ball is that it's affected by innocence. Like, it doesn't work in the presence of innocence. And I like that as a thing to weave into Kennet, because innocence aren't really in great supply in Kennet these days anyway. We also learn a bit more about Hazel, like kind of how using any of Hazel's practices is this really political sort of thing you have to do, like navigate where some people hate it, some people don't. And we get a bit more confirmation that the reason everyone who was around her got killed was because they let her go, basically, which I just thought was a bit funny. I kind of get it. I mean, it seems like she was a real asset. I can't believe they let her go. But I guess, you know, she spent some time in reality and didn't really enjoy it, so she went back to the paths.
Or, as we say in Hawaii, shoots, mob 'em good kind grinds, bruh.
Yeah, totally, Ruben. What else happens here? Oh, yeah, so obviously we get the tearaway kid getting his girlfriend back, like, awesome. I couldn't help but notice that the first time I read this, Avery compares the size of Edeline, I think it is, to Kennet, and I was instantly like, ooh, can we make her the lost side of Kennet? But 16.4 seems to imply that it's a different thing, which is a shame, because I would have loved for... Because they mentioned that Edeline will probably just get bound again because she has a weight in the paths. I was like, oh, well, let's bind her to Kennet if she is keen on that. Seems like a good idea. So, I don't know. Maybe we'll see. I feel like having a big sort of mobile third of Kennet that, like, soars through the paths would be really cool. But, yeah, doesn't seem to be the case. Anyway, going back to the build-up, I love this path. It's sort of constantly... building upwards as it's getting demolished at the bottom. It's this like perfect exaggeration of like a late stage capitalism vibe. I found it like just inherently upsetting, and then realized that was because it's the world, you know, writ large. David Hunt on our Discord compared it to like just this embodiment of the rat race, and I really love that way of saying it. It's just, you know, everyone's constantly building up so that they don't get demolished at the bottom. But yeah, so anyway, speaking of, they get started on the path. Avery's hanging out with Liberty. Jude and his cousins run off to do a sort of different version of it. And, it's, you know, it's a path. It's a chaotic mess right from the start. In no small part because Liberty opens the path by, revealing to Avery that she's bi. And, this is just like a really hilarious moment because like, this is a path where they're literally hopping over this void of nothing that wouldn't even kill them. It would extinguish them from existence if they fall in. But, you know, for Avery, that's nothing, right? Like, we need to add tension here by relationship drama. Like, you know, Avery doesn't get phased by crazy others and voids of nothingness that will extinguish her. She gets thrown off by, wait, shit, is my friend bi? Has she been hitting on me? Like, what's going on? And I love the way that doesn't feel like the cheap CW drama Sheridan and Liberty watch, but... It comes across really, really well, and it's Wilbo like upping the stakes in a way for a character who wouldn't be as phased by these stakes. But yeah, I mean, not only does this chapter shut down the beautiful Avery and Liberty ship that a lot of people have been on, but it's also in this section that my special Jude and Liberty ship is also dashed. Apparently, Jude can't stand the goblins. It's very sad. It seems like Liberty is destined to be alone as long as she's idolizing her dad. So hopefully we can sort that out for her. Yeah. So anyway, they make it through the path. I mean, there's a lot to talk about here. I'll skip over most of it. Obviously Liberty does her goblin flying, which is great. Very jealous of that. Best practice ever. Snowdrop narrowly misses getting some delicious milk, but is whisked away by Avery, unfortunately. Anyway, at the end of the day, they all make it. And then we skip to sort of after the path, and Nora shows up at Avery's house. And then we cut to Nora's perspective for a bit, which, you know, was very unexpected for me, at least. I didn't know that was allowed. I thought that was against the rules. But yeah, fun format break. We go back. It's like a really great flashback. And Liberty is just living up to her reputation as like a kind of aggressive sweetheart, I guess. Like, she's wing-womaning hard here, which I think was Crawford's big prediction last week. But it's in this really fair way where she's like, I like her and I will take her unless you take her because I think you'd be better. Like, it's just, It's a wildly mature thing for someone like Liberty to do. So, yeah, I hope once we take care of Anthem, Liberty can find her own, I don't know, redhead. That seems to be the thing that she's going for. But, yeah, so Nora asks Avery out here when we flash back to the current time. And then Avery goes upstairs to sort of meet up with Liberty, and they confirm that they're still going to be friends. Like, Liberty doesn't take this bad at all. Like, again, just continues to bat it out of the park. And so, yeah, everything's going well, and we end the chapter on another positive note as Liberty leaves to go hang with her dad.
Time for Janine to swoop in.
No, Ruben, unfortunately not. Maybe next week. But yeah, I don't know. Very close to a perfect ending. We have this moment of Avery debating whether or not to tell Liberty, and I think she's right that it's going to fall on deaf ears. So yeah, we'll see. It's going to be a rough one when Liberty sort of has to come to terms with Anthem, and I don't think anyone's looking forward to seeing it happen, even Toad Swallow. But yeah, so I guess that's 16.3, and then we cut ahead to 16.4, and this is from Lucy's perspective. We've cut back to Kennet. Marlon is still staying at Chloe and Nibble's Boo and Breakfast. Today, she's getting a guest lecture from Cherry Pop on the path she's making with Snowdrop. And there's also some catering from Biscuit. And I mean, I fucking love Biscuit here. Like, this is just amazing. Somebody, Elven Path on our Discord, described these drinks as equal parts "that is super cool" and "I wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole," which is perfectly Goblin. And I absolutely agree with Elven Path. Like, what I love about Biscuit's drinks is just they're so fucking gross, but also they do have cool abilities. Like, you know, you can time travel forward. You can, you know, get your mojo while drunk or whatever. There's a lot of, I think Lucy calls out how problematic some of it is, and Biscuit's excitedly like, yeah, it's great. Yeah, I fucking love Biscuit. I hope she gets her Barney one day again. But yeah, it's also funny that we open this chapter with Cherry Pop doing this whole thing about making her path, because it really sort of, this is the idea that we're going to end the chapter on. So it's a really nice sort of way to jokingly prime us for considering the idea of how you bring lost things and kind of help shape them. I'm secretly optimistic that Cherry Pop might get her wish and Lost Kennet can have a big slide for her with lots of rocks. And it's also great that she's kind of pitching this at Marlon, because this is like Marlon's whole thing is she's detached from reality. She is kind of a little bit lost, and she seems to know more about the paths than most of the other practitioners we've sort of seen from. So you're kind of sitting here thinking, oh, like, can we get Marlon on side? And then Marlon will, you know, be really handy for this, because she understands a lot more about being a lostish thing in reality. Like, I don't know. I've just, ever since we met Marlon in Basil's interlude, she seemed great. She just needs to stop being a dick. So I just want them to get her there. And of course, she also, you know, coordinates a bit with Verona here. Marlon and Verona share a hatred of the human body. But it's very fun seeing the two of them connect, where Marlon's like, oh, now I have to deal with my human body, and normally I don't have to. You're like, God, you can just see the connections being made in Verona's head during this conversation. Again, just Marlon, she'll be fucking great to have around if we can get her to stop, you know, human trafficking and, you know, just those little minor things that she keeps doing. So yeah, as this sort of goes on, Lucy hops into the bathroom and finds some escape tools that Marlon has been preparing and drops some curses on them. And I mean, I love this. I love how Lucy's continuing to explore cursing as her sort of primary form of practice. It's especially within the context of what they're doing to Marlon, I guess, because these punishments are very much designed to suit the crime. Like, it does feel like she's doing this good balance of, if you do the wrong thing, this curse will hurt you sort of as much as you deserve for doing the wrong thing. And this is kind of the whole thing with curses that I'm loving seeing explored through Lucy, is curses are a really great justice tool in the right hands. Like, someone like Lucy, who can set up curses to punish you for doing bad things, they're actually really cool. The problem is the curses don't discriminate based on who's setting them up. So, you know, you can get dickhead practitioners who presumably set up bad curses. And it's such a great tool of justice to explore, because they're great in the right hands and terrible in the wrong ones. And like, Lucy is the right hands, but how can you ensure that, you know, if Lucy was to get corrupted, or, you know, if she wants to systematize this, like, how do you ensure that they maintain their power only in the right circumstances? Yeah, it's such a great thing to explore.
And that's why Lucy is the best Kenneteer ever.
Yeah, thanks, Ruben. Of course, Ruben thinks that. So yeah, after doing her bathroom pass, Verona does a bathroom pass on top of Lucy, and you know, finds some things that she actually brings out. And then the gang start getting ready to talk to Liz. They're doing some more stops. But before they're allowed to go, Chloe has a quick request to ask for Lucy. She's been trying to work on her cooking, and she wouldn't mind if Lucy was a bit of a taste tester. And I mean, this is so fun. It gives me tons of vibes of that episode of Futurama where Bender became a chef, but because he couldn't taste, like, he was just shit at it. Chloe's vibe here is just like, she's, the universe keeps trying to tell her, no, you can't have nice things. And Chloe just tells the universe to go fuck itself and keeps trying to have nice things. And it's so endearing. Like, you just want nice things for Chloe. I can see Aziza did it already saying that in the chat as well. Chloe deserves every good thing. She absolutely does. Like, she's just trying to be her best, most wholesome self in a world that is just trying to turn her into a murder ghoul. I really want to see her and Nibble running like the Boo and Breakfast at the end of the story, where, like, you know, Chloe is cooking and kind of doing terribly at the domestics, while Nibble is annoying the customers by putting on shitty old movies and telling them all about who made it and stuff. You know, like that old guy at every other B&B. Chloe's she's always a shining light in this story. And unfortunately, we do have to leave her for a bit. And so Lucy and Verona, they're sort of walking over to Guillaume's man cave, and they have this kind of awkward chit-chat where Lucy's prying for information from Verona, and Verona gets her hackles up, and they kind of resolve it, but it's just a bit awkward. And it's really got that vibe of, like, these two are on the way to becoming friends again, but there's still very clearly this sore spot on Verona's side. And I think Verona realizes she was being unfair in this conversation when Lucy justifies it, but it's still like, that sore spot is still there, I guess. And it's going to be a long road forward. If it's even possible for these two to be who they were at the start of the story and just like innately trusting each other. And then Miss is also in the cave, which is, yeah, I mean, Miss basically tells us here she's planning on leaving. And I guess we'll get to the job pitch the Kenneteers have for her at the end of the chapter. But, like, God, you can see why Miss is thinking that at this stage. Like, she's lost everything. They've helped her come to terms with the fact that she's lost everything. And, you know, then there's this just idea of, well, why am I sticking around then? I can't really fault it. Guillaume brings up, you know, how that's going to turn into running as a pattern for her. And, you know, you can't avoid these patterns, but yeah, I don't know. And I guess, like, the other side of this as well, like the feeling of dead endness for Miss is really kind of accentuated by the fact that Guillaume is the person she's having to come to for counsel. Like, she talks about how Rook and Toad Swallow and all the others all can't really give her counsel for one reason or another. And Guillaume's her only option. It's like, well, shit, you know, if you think you're in a dead end and your only option is Guillaume, you're definitely in a dead end.
Or as we say in Hawaii, if can, if no can, no can.
Yeah, true, Ruben. We'll get to Miss again later, I suppose. But they leave Miss behind, and Lucy, Verona, and Guillaume all just, you know, normally, harmlessly walk from the cave to the refugee house. And while they're here, they meet up with Tashlet and some others and offer some of these refugees some new jobs in the Undercity and kind of just a way out of this house. And this is something I definitely love to hear from like the chat, like what people think of this offer, because it's very much a, like, you have to go and work for this place, and it's like room and board. Like, it feels feels very kind of boxed in, but at the same time, because it's not compulsory, I kind of like it as this like decent option for, hey, if you're sick of this house and you want something to do, the cinema and the arena could use people working them. And I also love it from the angle of like the Undercity. The cinema and the arena have been such contested territory. Getting employees from the ex-family man kind of helps keep it neutral and doesn't like skew things too far towards the Bitter Street Witch or the vice principal. I'm glad some of them seem keen on it. I don't know. I could see, it's one of those things where for those who aren't keen on it, like, I guess they just have to keep sitting in this house. Like it sucks. I guess I'm skipping over. There's just a bunch of smaller character moments here. This is classic Pale Reflection sort of stuff where there's just too many small moments to cover on the podcast. Like, we get a little confirmation. Tashlet still hasn't responded to Verona, and that's continuing to be awkward. Matt gives his first in-text confirmation that the Doom is going to start dwindling soon. Guillaume's obviously still being difficult as hell throughout this whole section. And then Lucy's talking to Grandfather.
Lucy, leave that poor dog alone.
Oh, I mean, that's probably fair, Ruben. I guess they're back up acquired, which is Grandfather, Tashlet, Matt, and Guillaume. It's time for the meeting with Miss. And so they call Miss they call Liz, and they don't get her. They get someone even worse. Chucky shows up first, and he gainsays the duo for 24 hours. I love this. Like, I love how Verona is determined to fight this gainsaying. We've obviously seen her get gainsaid a number of times in this story. We've been in her head when it happens, and she fucking despises it. Like, this is, yeah, like, Verona hates being gainsaid because it takes agency from her in a really tangible way. Like, the magic that she does have is very much what gets her through the day, and Charles taking it, yeah, she really hates that. And, you know, and this is why it takes her a few more minutes than Lucy to really come to terms with it. And I think the fact that Lucy was here and able to offer her a place to stay for the night made a really big difference in that regard, because Lucy just immediately sees what's happening, whereas Verona can't let herself admit it for a while. And part of the frustration, especially on Verona's side here, is Charles isn't even pretending to be genuine here. Like, this is exactly what we saw in 14.z with people like Marlon. Like, he is more than willing to fold on any of his bullshit gainsays. He's just here to be a pain in the ass, and he's so openly just undermining everything that the system stands for. I'm kind of into it. I kind of love how brazenly he's just saying, like, fuck it, I don't give a shit. Like, this is, like, on the nose, just completely nothing. I suppose, you know, we get some more stuff about how Charles has a plan here. So we'll save that for learning more about that plan later. It's not too surprising, I suppose, that Charles does have a plan. As he mentions, he was doing this for a decade. Like, but I think we knew that there had to be more to what he was thinking. But this is such a great example of Charles gainsaying the pair here. There's a world in which that's actually a really cool thing to do. Like, not for 24 hours, not just one side, but the idea of having a meeting like this between groups with a lot of tension and saying, hey, why don't we take magic, essentially take weapons out of the equation, form a little truce. Like, there's a nugget of a really good idea there. Like, gainsayings within the grounds of a meeting, creating a safe space with no weapons. I love it. But of course, this is Charles, so it takes the form of, it only happens to their side, it's 24 hours, even though it's not going to be a 24-hour meeting. Like, yeah, classic Charles. He's got a good idea in principle there, and he just executes it in the shittiest way possible. But I continue to just, love him as a villain. There's a moment where Matt tells him that John and Ken deserved better, and Charles retorts with, perhaps when I'm done, the other Johns and Kens of the world will get what they deserve. And this is just like, this is why I love Charles as a villain, because that is a good point. It completely ignores all the stupid shit he's been doing. But like, at his core, he's just got a really good point that you could almost justify. And like, that's what just makes him such a compelling villain, is like, you know, there's a world where he's right when he's saying that. And there's a world where he could be the good hero protagonist of a story. He's so close to being there. It's great. I can't wait to see what the next phase of his plan is. Like, all he seems to be doing so far is allowing Musa to gain momentum and weakening the sway of words, which, you know, we've been told that hurting words like this hurts the others more than the practitioners. So, like, it can't be his whole plan to just do that. Like, I can't wait to learn more and see what we're going to get, because it's going to be crazy. Zykri raises a good point in that Charles has very clearly been establishing 24 hours as a thing per infraction for his gainsays. Like, when he gainsaid people for a year, it was based on, like, you know, 365 gainsays. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing he's setting up. I don't know. Maybe, like, God, there's a world where all he's doing is getting rid of forswearing as a permanent fixture, which is like, oh God, I could almost get behind that as a plan. I can't wait for this meeting, y'all. So let's keep getting there. They sort of, after Charles Gaines says them, they're then left there waiting for Liss. So they call Miss out, and here Verona and Lucy kind of pitch to her this new thing they're thinking, where basically they want the third realm of Kennet to be our founded or a lost part, and they want Miss to take on a bit of a leadership role within that lost Kennet. And this is just such a juicy dilemma to put on Miss's plate, because we've just established earlier in the chapter she has no options, she's trapped, she's alone. But also, asking her to do this is kind of asking her to give up everything she stood for a chance of getting the Kennet that isn't quite what she wants. It's such a, I guess, as Miss is trying to come to terms with what she can be now and how she can avoid becoming a rook who has this idea that this loss is always going to happen, to present her with an option for a compromised version of what she wants at the risk of sacrificing everything that she is. Like, it's just so, yeah. Like, as Zykri's saying in chat, like, she is lost, and you know, they're offering a way for her to get found, but that goes against what she wants. Oh, yeah. I can't wait to see more of her thoughts on this, and, you know, to hear her talk it out with Avery and Snowdrop. And I just also want to get more info. I don't know if people in the chat have more of an idea of what a lost Kennet looks like. Like, I guess I had the impression, as I mentioned, when I read 16.3, I was like, oh, they can get Edeline, the big, like, bird city in it, and she could be the third part. But it almost sounds more like you build something from Kennet, you take a segment of Kennet and you push it away from reality. Like, so it's going to be Kennet writ lost, not something lost drawn into Kennet. Although I guess the way the paths work, it'll be a bit of both. But like, in order to create it, it sounds like the primary thing they need to do is, like, lose part of Kennet. And I'm very interested to see what that looks like. And, you know, we've been talking about how the wolf is going to come back into the story, and if they're shoveling some part of Kennet, like, path adjacent, you know, with that tied into like Avery, that just sounds like an invitation for the wolf. So this is just a very exciting idea, I think. And also, just, I guess, mechanically, I'm interested in the idea of how do you, like, intentionally lose part of Kennet? Is this one of those impacts that the Garrick's talked about? Do they get Edeline to land in Kennet for a bit, and that creates an impact that lets them lose part of it? I don't know. Yeah, as is it, I totally agree. Like, something similar to the promenade, if it acts like a gate for Lost to come in and out of the paths, like an entrance to the paths, I see that really being true to what Kennet was, and that would be one of those things you could see Miss stomaching. Anyway, as they talk about this with Miss, this is when Liz makes her big dramatic entrance, and, you know, on top of things like Verona asking for her domain and, you know, setting up this third thing of Kennet, we get all the villains showing up saying there's going to be terms, and, you know, this chapter ends on the cliffhanger of it's time to start talking those terms. And this is, oh, I mean, this... this arc is really dragging out this confrontation. 16.1 gave us the impression we were almost there. It's now, you know, 2 weeks later, and we maybe are going to get it next chapter. But it's so hype. I love the decision Wildbo's made to have all of the culprits show up. Like, I just love the idea that the culprits, the villains of this story, are presenting a unified front. And, like, Kennet really isn't. I mean, this is as good a front as they've got right now. But, this is just kind of some stragglers Lucy and Verona were able to pick up. Avery's not here. Whereas, you know, Charles, Edith, and Marisica are all standing tall as a trio. You know, the dark reflections of our Kenneteers sort of a lot more unified than the Kenneteers are right now. And I can't wait to see this confrontation. Like, because this means it's going to go beyond just asking Liz for stuff. This is going to be, hopefully, a conversation that pivots a lot more to the grander moral differences between these two groups, which I can't wait to see, because as we're talking about with Charles before, there's a world where these guys all get along and want the same things. They're just they're so close to being there, but there's these small differences, and the things that the culprits have done mean that you know the rest of Kennet can never get on side with them. And it's going to be so fun to see that concept explored and constantly distracting from talking business next chapter. Like, you know, especially with Marisica here, there's going to be a lot of distractions. Like, fuck, the rest of the group don't even know that Marisica doesn't want to be a fairy yet, as far as we know. Like, yeah. Yeah, Zachary, you've already brought this up on chat. Like, yeah, Marisica, nobody else knows that Marisica's trying to shed being a fairy yet. What does that mean? I mean, we know that she's lost her wings thanks to Gilkey in 15.z. That gets reconfirmed here. I don't know if that's part of that plan or not. I guess we'll see. But yeah, is she going to start dropping those bombshells, talk around it? I guess for her, that's the same thing. Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, so that's these two chapters. We're ending on some big cliffhangers, mostly on Kennet's side. I really hope 16.5 is going to be this confrontation. It's going to be so great. But that's everything I've got to talk about this week. Obviously, we're not doing discussion questions at the moment because it's just me. And those of you who are here live will know that I was already an hour late because I'm a bit of a mess at the moment. So don't worry, Ruben will be back in 2 weeks, and you know, that'll be good for everyone. But yeah.
Or as we say in Hawaii, mele kaliki maka.
Yeah, thanks, Ruben. For those who aren't from Hawaii like myself and had to Google what Ruben said just there, it's Merry Christmas, I think, in Hawaiian. So yeah, I guess Merry Christmas to everyone, especially those of you who are here live in the chat, because I know in most parts of the world it's Christmas. And yeah, I'll be back next week to, you know, talk about some more chapters. And, you know, I promise Ruben will be back soon. But yeah, there'll be a discussion thread for this episode if you want to comment on any of the rambling I did in this episode. We're also on Twitter. Ruben has specifically written here that he wants me to mention the memes that we're doing. He's very proud of these memes, so go check them out. Doofmedia.com, that's our website. That's where all of our shows are listed. You know, pale in comparison, have you been listening to this episode and thinking, gosh, I wish I could hear more from Malia and Jenny? Well, go to Pale in Comparison and hear them talk about Pact and Pale. That's the way to do it. You can also support them and us at the Doof Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. All of our like equipment and budget and stuff comes from that Patreon. These shows wouldn't be what they are without it. And obviously, of course, patreon.com/wildbow is the place to go to keep getting more of this story. Like, you know, without that Patreon, we wouldn't be getting this confrontation coming up. So, you know, give him some money if you can. Throw him a Christmas present. And yeah, I guess with that, I'll see everybody next week.